no other issue drove me to the United States Senate more than criminal justice reform, because I've seen what it's done to the American society. It's a cancer on the soul of our country. I know for sure if Dick Durbin was not a senator, we would not have this day. And I want to tell you, I live in an inner city community with people who have been adversely affected by an unfair, unjust war on drugs. You are a champion, my friend, and I am so grateful that you are my friend and that you have allowed me in this last 5 years to be your partner on getting this over the finish line. Hi, it's Cory Booker, and welcome again to another edition of Lift Every Voice. I cannot tell you, I am so excited about this episode because I am just literally hours have now passed since what was yesterday, effectively around 8, a little after 8 o'clock, where we passed a historic piece of legislation called the First Step Act, which we'll get to in a second. But my guest today really is my champion on criminal justice reform in the United States Senate. When I was a very new senator about 5 years ago, I came to the Senate to work on criminal justice reform. It was one of the things that drove me to want to try to run for the Senate in the first place. And the guy who, when I landed on the Senate floor in the Democratic caucus, who kind of took me under his arm, who had already had the seminal piece of legislation to do sentencing reform, is a man named Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois. And I have him as my guest today. He led the charge to get this legislation passed. And I just want to thank him and welcome him to this podcast. Thank you, Senator Durbin.
Thanks, Corey. And it was a team effort. And I was just happy as heck that you were by my side. It was a great, great feeling on the floor last night. I think we made history.
Clearly we did. And I'd like to just go back a while because Senator Durbin, the thing that often makes me sad about you is that some of the best speeches I've ever heard you give, there's no press to listen to. It's when you stand up and you corral our caucus on moral issues. You are really one of the people that is a moral voice in the Democratic caucus, talking about the people that are often left behind, the folks that don't have lobbyists. I've seen you stand up and talk for immigrants and DACA kids, and then clearly on criminal justice reform before I even got to the United States Senate. Now, you said something during the press conference, which was I thought was really moving, because you just told the truth about how we got into a certain hole and how you've been on a mission for years and years and years now to dig out of it. Maybe we can start there.
Well, I said at the press conference, and I've said many times, you don't often hear a senator preface a speech by saying, let me tell you about the worst vote I ever cast.
Wow.
The worst vote I ever cast was 1986. Along had come the crack cocaine. And we were told, be frightened, be very frightened. It's dirt cheap. It's easy to produce, highly addictive, so destructive, particularly to pregnant women. And if you don't move and move quickly, it's going to swamp America. That's what we were told. And the debate was really gaining steam. And then there was an event which occurred. It didn't involve crack cocaine, but it came at a moment in the history of the Washington, D.C. area where no one missed it. There was a great basketball player at the University of Maryland, Lynn Bias. He was destined for the NBA. He died of an overdose. Not crack cocaine, but he died of an overdose in the midst of this debate. And it just propelled this issue forward. The next thing you know, I'm voting for the 100-to-1 crack powder disparity, mandatory minimums, and three strikes you're out. I mean, it was as harsh and tough as could be. We used muscle all the way. And it failed. Failed miserably. The net result of it, more drugs in the street, lower prices for those drugs, and we started filling the prisons, primarily with African Americans and Latinos. And it reached a breaking point where I said to myself, if that is not the most failed policy, I don't know what is. Got to do something about it. 10 years ago, I introduced a bill, change it from 100-to-1 to 1-to-1, crack and powder. And off I went, and I ended up with my enemy, nemesis in the battle, Jeff Sessions, senator from Alabama. How about that? And so here we are faced with the markup in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I run into him in the Senate gym. As I often say, I go to the Senate gym every day for no apparent reason. But I run into him in the Senate gym, and I said, Jeff, we got to do something. We can't leave this at 100-1. Well, okay, Dick, I'll take 25-1. I said, 25? That's terrible. Thinking in my head, 100-25 is a big forward leap.
Right.
And I said, make it 10. I'm talking about how laws are made.
Yes.
I said, make it 10. He said, no way, I'll do 20. And I said, okay, 15. Nope, 18. That was it. We agreed on 18. The bill went through the Senate Judiciary Committee by voice vote, the Senate floor by voice vote, House Judiciary by voice vote, House floor by voice vote, and there I was at a signing ceremony just a few weeks later with Jeff Sessions, Durbin, and President Obama in his office. No cameras, no nothing.
Wow.
But that was a first step.
And I just want to say, so you had this period in American history where Democrats and Republicans were lining up to put harsher and harsher sentences, not just crack cocaine, but you know, since 1980 till now, the federal prison population ballooned 800%. The states were following suit or leading with a 500% increase in the overall prison population. And you, though, led the charge, started very early. You were sort of broke with all of that, leading with this fight that got – and it's amazing. The first time you told me that story when I first got to the Senate about two guys in a gym, you fighting for 1-1, but – finding a way, not based on science or what the drug is or any kind of chemical analysis, you were able to battle it back to 18-1 and get it signed by then President Obama. And really, you began, you didn't stop there. You went right back to work to try to start taking down these mandatory minimums, these three strikes throughout, all the things that exploded the prison population. And I guess I just want to get to that moment where you find a partner on the other side to do the bill that most inspired me when I got to the United States Senate. Can you tell us about who that partner is?
Yeah, it was an interesting partnership there. After we passed the first bill, Fair Sentencing Act, 8 years ago, the Sentencing Commission stepped in and said, we're going to make this retroactive. And I said to Sessions, who had worked with me on the number, join me in a letter to them, encouraging them to do that. So more and more people, he wouldn't do it.
Okay, so that's really important. When you say make it retroactive, the bill as you guys passed it, for anybody now that gets convicted, it's no longer 100-1. It's lowering the penalties. But there were a whole bunch of people, thousands of people that were still being held in prison to the 100-1. The example I gave at the press conference was that people got sentenced under the 100-1. If you had – the person that got sentenced the next day was down to 18-1.
That's right.
And now that person that was in jail for the 100 runs watched other people come in and out of prison. It was August 2nd versus August 3rd, 2010. And you're like, well, God, if the law of the land is X, why are people suffering under that mistaken law? But now I've never heard you tell this part of the story where you tried to make it retroactive.
Well, the Sentencing Commission stepped in and they started moving in that direction. And I asked Senator Sessions to join me. He said, we never talked about retroactive. And that was the end of that partnership. So I kind of sat out there trying to think, what's the next step? And lo and behold, along comes a man who has been judged the most conservative senator in the United States Senate by the New York Times. He is from Utah and his name's Mike Lee. Mike Lee had been a law clerk to then-Judge Sam Alito when he was on the circuit court bench. He'd been an assistant U.S. attorney, a prosecutor, but a case came before him, and he never forgot it. It was a fellow named Weldon Angelos. I've heard this story so many times. Arrested for selling three dime bags of marijuana and having a gun on his person. And when they sat down to sentence him, when they put all the enhancements in, they sentenced him to 55 years in prison. 55 years for what I just described.
Yeah.
And Lee was outraged. The judge who, I think it was Judge Paul Castle, who had to impose this sentence, wrote a lengthy opinion saying how awful this was, that he had no other choice. Lee decided when he got here he was going to do something about it. We ended up sharing a lunch or a meeting one day, and the next thing you know, we were co-sponsors of a bill to change it.
And so that was 2012, 2013?
I'm trying to think. It was 6 years ago, so it had been about 2012.
And it was amazing that suddenly you have a guy that I hope you don't mind me describing you this way, but one of the more progressive members of our caucus.
Proud of it.
Proud of it. And one of the most – the most ranked most conservative person suddenly partnering on a bill. And in many ways, that was the vanguard of something I started watching from Newark as mayor at that time, where I'm like, wait a minute. You have the Manhattan Institute. You have the Koch brothers, Heritage Foundation. You had these conservative groups, these Christian evangelicals – starting to echo what Mike Lee is saying. And then obviously on our side of the aisle, there was a lot of people that were there. But you created this partnership. I land in the United States Senate about a year later. And you have a president that's committed to this. And what I always say, one of the more moving moments of me as a senator, and I've had a lot of them, and I can't – to people listening, you have to understand what it means to be a junior new senator and then to find one of the ranking members in the Senate, one of the – part of the leadership that looks at you and says, hey, young man, I'm going to let you to the table. So imagine this. I'm a new senator. I'm sitting around. I'm in the White House at a summit meeting that Barack Obama has called with people on both sides of the aisle. I'm sitting at the table. And again, thanks to people like you who got me made me a part of this coalition to try to do something about this. And I'll never forget, you've probably forgotten this moment, it's your turn to speak as one of the first people to speak that's been fighting on this issue that has the premier bill. And you said, well, I've got to tell you all something. I'm really encouraged because a new guy has come to the Senate. And I snap my head up when you say my name. And you really put me in play. And I cannot appreciate that enough. And I heard from Valerie Jarrett today, who congratulated us on the bill. But can you talk about what was important in the last Congress under Barack Obama? What happened there with a chairman and something that got done that ended up becoming key that we had made that progress last Congress?
Well, I can tell you that we eventually decided we needed Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, to be part of this effort. He opposed us. And I thought to myself, I'm going nowhere.
And I want to characterize that opposition because I'm now a young new senator sitting. He used to go to the floor.
Yes.
And rail against the efforts of you and Mike Lee and others trying to push. And so for you to get him from not just opposing this quietly, I mean, he was a leader in the opposition to what you were trying to do.
He was. And I went to him. We'd been friends and knew one another pretty well for many, many years. And I said to him, Chuck, I can't pass this bill without you. There's no way. You're chairman of the committee. I've got to reach a point where you and I agree on what this bill should say. Are you willing to sit down and do it? And he said, sure.
Wow.
And it took a year. And by Senate standards, that's a flash of lightning.
Yeah.
It took a year for us to come up with language. Just to be very honest about this, I ended up giving up 30% of the people that I wanted to help. 30% of them. I mean, and these are hard, you know, heartbreaking decisions, but you think 70% have a chance if I can get this done. Grassley signs on as the lead sponsor. He's chairman of Judiciary. We report the bill out of the committee.
And can I just say, so this is my first real experience as a senator seeing the sausage being made. And that's when the nobility of and you taught me a lot about this. I remember a lot of the wisdom you said, like, Corey, I've learned in this process that if you're offered half a loaf, take it off the table and then go back to work again. So you sort of counseled me to understand that, yeah, we were giving up something, but don't let perfect be the enemy of good. There are real lives at stake here, real people that we can help, even if we don't get everything we want. I still remember the moment that on the Senate floor when the final part of the deal was done. It was you were standing there. This never really happens on the Senate floor, but I still remember this great staffer that Grassley had, who's now since left the Senate, but he was tough as nails, comes out and we agree on a juvenile provision. Grassley and I shake hands. We all have a deal. We're all happy with the bill. And now we have to sell it to the Judiciary Committee to try to get it out of the Senate and to Barack Obama. And so what happens in the Judiciary Committee?
Well, of course, we end up getting it approved in the committee.
Yes.
And
voted out.
And voted out in the committee. And we're all pretty happy about it because it's a bipartisan vote.
Yes.
On its way out to the floor. And then we run into Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
Who basically says, no way, not going to do this. This bill's never going to be on the calendar. And there were a number of reasons behind it. I think some of it was the memory of Willie Horton as an issue.
Can you explain to people, because I know there's young people that might not know.
Well, if you go back to the race with Michael Dukakis, the governor of Massachusetts, Democratic nominee for president.
Against the first Bush.
Against George Herbert Walker Bush. And they dredge up this ad about someone that was released from prison in Massachusetts and turned around and committed another crime. It was a horrifying ad. The man was an African American, and they didn't hide that fact in the ad. And they just beat the living heck out of Dukakis with this man, Willie Horton.
Yeah, that dripped with racial implications. It was an awful, god-awful ad and really haunts it,
and
me.
And I'll tell you, it is embedded in the genetic code of every politician in America. You're going to get Willie Horton if you're not careful when it comes to criminal justice. I mean, it came up during the course of this debate from one of our colleagues in the Senate in committee. Well, there sits McConnell saying no with, I think, the Willie Horton aspect. But equally so, he's got a divided caucus. Within his caucus are some senators, I don't know if you want me to name names, but have just basically said not only no, but hell no. We're not going to let this bill come forward. McConnell is trying to stay away from controversy, be a popular leader. So he says to Grassley, not going to happen. We're just not going to call this bill.
And one of those names we can mention, our former colleague, Jeff Sessions. This is the guy that was one of the champions in fighting against what we were trying to do. It's one of the reasons why I came out so vociferously against him for attorney general, because I knew he would try to turn back a lot of the progress that the Obama Justice Department made. So he's got people standing up in caucus threatening people with this specter. If one of those people gets out of jail and does a crime, it's on you. And people are afraid of getting outflanked to the right on law, so-called law and order.
It's exactly right. And you got to remember that Sessions went on to be AG, and we can talk about that chapter in a minute. But there he was, along with others, fighting us every step of the way. Curious thing, you may remember this. You sat through the hearing for his appointment to the as Attorney General. He gets up and makes his opening statement and says, and of course, Senator Durbin and I agreed on the Fair Sentencing Act, bringing it from 100 to 18. And I'm thinking, I added when I got on, but I said, when I asked you to make it retroactive, you wouldn't join me in that. So, there was some daylight between us on positions. Well, we had no luck with McConnell, and then came a new president.
Right. And so understand this. They call this the zombie bill last night. Some people are calling it because it just would not die. It dies in that Congress. New president elected. New Congress is in session. And you go back to work. And I want to fast forward because I want to talk about what's in the bill. But I just want to set this up. Long story short, they get something out of the House that you and I do not like. And can we pick it up from there? It comes out of the House called the First Step Act.
Well, it came out of the House, and it was prison reform. We didn't like it in its substance, and particularly unhappy with the fact it didn't include criminal sentencing.
Right.
It's a back-end fix, partial fix, but it doesn't deal with the criminal sentencing that puts people away for intolerable periods of time. So Grassley announces, and we join him in the chorus, and says, this bill is going nowhere in the Senate unless criminal sentencing is added to it.
Yes.
And so a lot of our friends, I mean, even the Black Caucus was split in the House of Representatives on the passage of that bill. It got 365 votes or something in that neighborhood. So it was a very popular bill. We knew it was a good start, but we had to change it, and we had to add criminal sentencing.
Which I love the fact this was a moment of powerful leverage. You would build up a reputation. You have a relationship already with Grassley. You already have a bill that has components of it that you would eventually get in this. But you, Grassley, me, I remember doing a letter with you and John Lewis, of all people, saying, without sentencing reform, this is not moving, which sent a signal to the White House and others that they had to deal. And I watched you from March of this year until literally we were working on this until it comes to the Senate floor. You got in there and you created a bill that included things from your original bill with Mike Lee, from our bill that came out of the Senate in the last Congress, and you plowed them into this bill. What are some of those components now that we are proud of? Not the whole loaf we didn't get, but besides the retroactivity of the Fair Sentencing Act that now will lead to the pathways of liberation for 2,000 to 3,000 human beings. I want to add that 90% of them are African Americans, 96% Black and Latino, because of that racial disparity with crack powder cocaine. But what are the other elements of this bill?
We went after mandatory minimums.
Yes.
And it's the first significant change in mandatory minimums in three decades. And what we basically said was that if you are in a category of crime, drug offense, nonviolence, no guns, cooperate with the government, that you'll be eligible for discretionary sentencing if your background, your criminal background, suggests you're in that category. Now, under the existing law, it's almost impossible to qualify for that discretionary treatment. We've expanded the categories and numbers of crimes to the point where more people will be eligible. But it's basic, that basic crime I just mentioned to you, the drug offense, no violence, no gun, cooperate with government, then you can be considered for that. So for the first time, many of the people we've discussed here, the Eugenie Jennings and others, would have had a second chance where people, the judge could have looked at it. The judge with Weldon Angelos, as an example, could have looked at it and said, you know, this is not right and I'm not going to do it.
Right.
We've finally broken that mold. And I think it really was a significant step forward.
Bringing down mandatory minimums, retroactivity of the first step, prevents the stacking that caused Weldon Angelos.
Stacking. It's just amazing. Same crime, three different bags of marijuana charged for three different crimes, gun in the pocket. It's 55 years, buddy.
Yeah. Yep.
Hard to imagine.
So a lot of the nightmares that we talked about for years, stacking, retroactivity, these terrible, terrible life sentences or three strikes you're out or 25 years, we were able to shave a lot of that down and create a lot more justice on the sentencing side. Would not happen if it wasn't for the line we drew in the Senate and your months and months of negotiation with your wingman running in and out, your sidekick. But I want to – it also helps programming when people come – to get people in prison so that they can earn time, lower recidivism, and ends the shackling of pregnant women. It effectively ends juvenile solitary confinement on the
federal – Thanks to you. Thanks to you.
And federal level and a lot of other good things, sir. And so I this is really – 5 years I've been in the Senate. This is one of the proudest things I've ever been involved in my life because it will affect thousands of people now. It will affect thousands of people into the future. And I just want to know for you, because I watched you in this, and I will say for as long as people want to hear what I have to say, that you are really the champion in the Democratic caucus for the issue that no other issue drove me to the United States Senate more than criminal justice reform, because I've seen what it's done to the American society. It's a cancer on the soul of our country. We churn the mentally ill. We churn the poor. We churn the addicted. We disproportionately churn black and brown people into a broken criminal justice system that treats you better in this country. As Brian Stevenson says, if you're rich and guilty, then poor and innocent. We, on the planet Earth, we've set records in humanity. One out of every three incarcerated women on the planet Earth are in the United States of America, even though we're just 5% of the population. I can go on and on and on. More African-American men incarcerated today or under criminal supervision today than all the slaves in 1850, that were slaves in 1850. So I could go on about how horrific this system is, but I have watched now for 5 years as you, who have been my guiding light on this, the champion, this has got to be one of those moments in your career that do you feel that sense of historic pride after decades of going in the wrong direction, blowing up the American prison population? How do you feel? I mean, you're within 24 hours of getting this done on the Senate floor, probably hours with it being signed by the president.
Well, I'll tell you how I feel. I told you at the start it was one of my worst votes, creating the 100-1 and all the rest of it. I finally feel like I'm getting it right. And the fact that I get it right means a lot of people will be treated right. Not all of them. We've still got a lot to do. This is just the opening. It is the first step, as we characterized it. There's a lot more that needs to be done. But we have finally decided, I think, as a nation, moving toward the feeling we're going to fight the war on drugs with our brains, not our muscles. We're going to think about ways that stop drugs coming into this country, to deal with the interdiction of them and also deal with the treatment of people in a much different way. It reflects the fact that the opioid epidemic, which has taken over in this country, has opened the eyes of people everywhere to the fact that this isn't a problem of the inner city anymore. There isn't any suburb too wealthy, no town too small to avoid this opioid epidemic. And people who are looking out at the victims are not seeing poor inner-city living people. They're seeing their brothers and sisters and sons and daughters. So they're starting to think about drugs in a different way. I think that we are evolving as a nation as we think about drugs and how to deal with them. I believe it's a scourge. It breaks my heart to hear when someone is addicted. But at least now we're not saying it's a moral curse and you're finished. We're saying to them it's a disease. We're going to treat it.
Well, I want to put it to you this way. If you were not a senator back in the 80s when those mandatory minimums and three strikes were out and the crack cocaine disparity, if you were not a senator, that would have happened anyway. It was where the herd was going. But I will say this. If you were not a senator now, the correction for that would not have happened. You were the guy on our side of the aisle.
Thanks.
And I know you're going to try to – clearly the White House, indispensable partner, clearly Grassley and Lee, indispensable partners – But as a Democrat in the Democratic caucus, I know for sure if Dick Durbin was not a senator, we would not have this day. And I want to tell you, I live in an inner city community with people who have been adversely affected by an unfair, unjust war on drugs. You are a champion, my friend, and I am so grateful that you are my friend and that you have allowed me in this last 5 years to be your partner on getting this over the finish line.
You've been a great partner. The man who brought me into politics was named Paul Simon. He was a senator in my state before me. He had some basic rules, and I live by them when it comes to public service. He said, you look for two things in public service, honesty and somebody who's willing to help the helpless. I always thought those were the North Star, the guideline when it comes to what I want to be as a member of the Senate, and I'll bet you do too.
Well, sir, beyond, I mean, because this is the thing for me, in this day of politics, where money pouring in, you seem to pick constituencies that have no lobbyists. You fight for people who come, who don't nobody fights for, and that are marginalized, and it's often a lonely place. But I admire you so much, and may my career be marked by the values that you exhibit every single day.
Well, I told you when I visit federal prisons, I'm a pretty well-known
name. Yeah, you are. But that, and I'm sorry to get, you know, I'm one of these guys that says, before you tell me about your religion, first show it to me and how you treat other people. So I don't want to talk religion. But, you know, Matthew 25, Jesus speaks, you know, when you visited me in prison. When I was in prison, you visited me. When I was hungry, you fed me. It goes through this long list, and if you read that, I've seen you not preach. I don't even know much about your faith, sir, but you live those values every single day that are exhibited in Matthew 25, and the fact that you go to prison to visit with the people you are fighting for, and that they know who you are, I think God looks upon that much more than the wealthy or the powerful knowing your name. The fact that folks who are on the margins of society, in the shadows of society, that you bring light to them and hope and are a champion, that to me is the greatest calling of this office and of humanity. So thank you.
Well, I would just tell you, flattery, as my old boss Paul Douglas once said, is like perfume. It's pleasant to the senses, but lethal if swallowed. So I thank you so much for your kind words. And I've got another cause, the Dreamers and
yes,
DACA.
We got to get this done.
Absolutely. And time's running out. They have court protection. It may end tomorrow.
And explain to folks who might not know what you mean when you say DACA or Dreamers.
I introduced the Dream Act 17 years ago. If you're brought to this country under the age of 16, grow up here, educated, no criminal record, you get a chance, a path to citizenship. That's what the Dream Act said. We couldn't pass it. Barack Obama, as president, created an executive order. 800,000 people signed up who would have been eligible for the DREAM Act.
They exposed themselves.
They did. They walked right into this government and said, here I am. And right now, those 800,000 can live in this country without fear of deportation and can legally work here. No thanks to President Trump. It was September of 2017 that he eliminated the program. We haven't replaced it. It's the court protection that's keeping these folks in a good legal position. We got to be ready to move quickly to save them and their families.
And this is eerily similar to criminal justice reform, because if you poll Americans, what do they say?
They're in favor of it.
Overwhelmingly.
Yeah, give them a chance. They know they came here as kids.
And the painful thing is, in my state, there are business owners.
Yes.
First responders, people that work with children, people who have been elevated through their service to others, their contributions to our economy. These are Americans in every single way, but a piece of paper showing guts, grit, even willingness to die for our country. But we have left them in states of insecurity that erodes at their sense of well-being that we have to address.
They changed your bed in the motel room last night, and they're watching your mom at the nursing home today.
Yes.
These are the folks that we trust with our kids at daycare. And to say that they're somehow ineligible to be part of the future of America is just, as a son of an immigrant, I take it personally.
Well, you deserve a Christmas break. I hope you're taking that and you're not running around Illinois. Knowing you, you might not take that long of a break, but take that break, because I know when we get back, there's two things I know for sure about Dick Durbin. You will be back working on criminal justice reform, because we're not finished there. that we will be working on DACA and Dreamers fixes, and that you'll allow this young senator from New Jersey to be your sidekick on those noble battles.
A Stanford Cardinal at my side. I can't fail.
Amen. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Corey.
Thank you for listening to this episode, which is really very personally important to me because I owe so much to Dick Durbin, as do so many of us. Thank you for listening to Lift Every Voice, and I'm wishing everybody a very happy new year. May we, all of us, do something for the cause of our country to make this a nation where the words liberty and justice for all are far more meaningful to all of us. Thank you.